There's a story that sometime in the early 1090s, a barefoot holy man made a dangerous pilgrimage to Jerusalem. The once reliable road to the Holy Land had become considerably more treacherous since the Turks had invaded the region. However, this pilgrim, perhaps because of his look of extreme poverty, managed to make his way to the holy city without serious incident. When he arrived at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, he was shocked by what he saw. The church had stood since the 4th century, and according to tradition, it contained two of the faith's holiest sites, the spot where Jesus had been crucified and the tomb where his body had been placed before the resurrection. But when this humble pilgrim arrived, he found the church stained with the blood of Christian martyrs. When he entered the church, he was greeted by the Patriarch of Jerusalem himself. The man was both surprised and relieved to see a Christian pilgrim. The patriarch confided in the holy man that it had been a dark time for the followers of the faith in Jerusalem. He worried loudly about how long it would be before the Muslim lords of the city would decide to destroy the Church of the Holy Sepulchre for good. The pilgrim was certainly distressed by this, but he was unsure how to help the beleaguered patriarch. However, he was keen to pray at the tomb of the Savior and make his devotional journey worthwhile. He asked the patriarch if he could spend the night in the church watching over the holy tomb. The patriarch agreed, and the pilgrim set himself up beside one of the holiest shrines in all of Christianity. It had been the pilgrim's intention to stay up throughout the night in quiet contemplation in the presence of the tomb. But the journey had taken its toll on the pilgrim, and eventually he drifted off to sleep. But just then, the pilgrim was graced with an incredible vision. Jesus Christ himself appeared. Even more incredibly, the Savior spoke to the humble man, and his message was crystal clear. It would be this pilgrim's mission to rouse all of Europe in a holy quest to liberate the city of Jerusalem. The next morning, the pilgrim explained his incredible vision to the patriarch. He had been given a great undertaking from the Son of God himself. If the patriarch would write a letter calling for help from the Christians of the West, this pilgrim would deliver it to Pope Urban II himself. He then swore that he would not rest until he raised a mighty army that could take Jerusalem. Amazed, the patriarch agreed to write the letter, and he placed it in the hands of this devout wanderer. The next day, the pilgrim set out for the coast, where he boarded a ship and set sail for Italy. Sure enough, he would eventually make contact with the Pope and deliver the letter from the Patriarch of Jerusalem. We're told that the Pope was moved by the contents of the letter and was just as impressed by the passion of the humble messenger who had delivered it. So he resolved that at the upcoming Council of Clermont, he would make a call for all devout Christians to take up the cross and bring holy war to those who currently occupied Jerusalem. The barefoot pilgrim who started it all was about to become one of the most important people in Europe. You see, that man was none other than Peter the Hermit, the true author of the First Crusade and one of its most charismatic leaders. At least, so goes the tale. The story of Peter's miraculous vision at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre has been an essential part of Crusader lore since the 11th century. The only problem is that it may have never happened. And I'm not just talking about the vision of Christ. The whole story might have been a massive piece of fake history. There's good reason to believe that Peter the Hermit may have never even visited Jerusalem before the Crusaders eventually conquered the city in 1099. That's to say nothing of meeting the patriarch, being issued a mission from Christ himself, and then delivering a letter that basically starts the First Crusade. You see, the sources about Peter are wildly contradictory. Most of the French chronicles of the Crusade do not mention this fortuitous journey to the Holy Land. And honestly, a vision of the Lord in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre seems like quite a thing to leave out. One Byzantine source tells us that in the years leading up to the Crusade, Peter tried to make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, but was unable to reach his goal. According to this source, it was the very fact that he didn't make it to Jerusalem that inspired him to preach the Crusade. So, with so many conflicting accounts, it can be hard to know what to believe about this absolutely remarkable figure. He may have single-handedly launched the Crusade, or he might have just jumped on the crusading bandwagon after Clermont. However, what is certain is that as soon as Peter the Hermit started preaching the Crusade, he would completely transform the scope of its mission. You see, for Peter, crusading was not just going to be the province of the elite. Where the Pope most likely intended knights and nobles to take up the cross, Peter had other ideas. In the mind of the hermit, crusading was going to be for everyone. He wanted shoemakers, blacksmiths, tanners, hunters, and even the poorest peasant farmers to drop what they were doing, join the cause, and head east to liberate the Holy Land. Peter's fiery preaching would help unleash a wave of crusading fervor across Europe. But as he would eventually learn, whipping up a crusade and controlling a crusade are two very different things. The intense emotional stew associated with crusading was a volatile mix of religious devotion, anger, hate, bloodlust, and excitement for one's complete salvation. That's a dangerous combo when found in just one person. So you can only imagine how it played out when it gripped a crowd of thousands. How much credit should Peter the Hermit be given for starting the First Crusade? Who was this obscure ascetic, and what were his true motivations for stirring up what would become known as the quote-unquote People's Crusade? Did Peter the Hermit truly believe he was on a mission from God, or was he just another charlatan drunk on the power he had over his followers? I mean, seriously, was Peter the Hermit even a hermit? All that and more on today's Our Fake History. Episode number 59, How Do You Explain the First Crusade, Part 2. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major, and this is the podcast where we explore historical myths and try and figure out what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. This week, we continue our series on the First Crusade. So what you're listening to right now is the second part of what will eventually be a trilogy of episodes. So if you haven't heard part one, it's probably a good idea for you to go back and give that a listen right now. That first part was all about the historical context that gave birth to the Crusades. I did my best to explain how the geopolitical situation had evolved in the Middle East since the armies of Islam first snatched the Holy Land from the Byzantine Empire in the late 600s AD. I then tried to offer some explanations about why the First Crusade happened at all in 1095. Along the way, I did my best to bust some myths about the relationship between Christians and Muslims. I also tried to put to rest the idea that medieval knights were somehow gallant and noble. I mean, sure, there may have been a handful of good guys in the mix, but as we saw in the last episode, most knights were the kind of people who would burn down your house, steal your goat, and hang you by the private parts. But before we go any further, I think I should clarify some of the language that I'm using. You see, throughout this series, I've been talking about crusading and crusaders, and I've been calling this whole event the First Crusade. You see, that is the name that historians have given this event, but it's important to note that in the 1090s, no one called what they were doing crusading. At that time, it was just called going on a pilgrimage, albeit a violent pilgrimage. It wasn't until the Third Crusade that the term crusader really came into vogue. So before anyone writes me an angry email, yes, I know that the term crusading is a little anachronistic when you're talking about this period. But because the campaign launched in 1095 would be the inspiration for all future crusades, historians tend to use the term crusading to describe it. So I'm going to follow suit, and I'm going to use it too. Now, one thing that you might have noticed is that the story that I gave you in the last episode about what started the First Crusade was actually quite different from the story I told you at the top of the show this week. Now, this wasn't some sloppy error on my part. It's because there are actually two competing narratives out there concerning who really started the First Crusade. Last week, I gave you the version of events that has become the mainstream consensus among historians. That is that the First Crusade was summoned after the Byzantine Emperor, Alexius Comnenus, sent emissaries to Pope Urban II asking for help in securing his borders against the Seljuk Turks. The Pope agreed to help, and during his famous speech at the Council of Clermont, he made his fateful call for the warriors of Christianity to head east and aid the Byzantines and the Eastern Christians. In this version of events, the authors of the Crusade were Pope Urban II and the Byzantine Emperor. However, for most of history, a very different person was given credit for launching the First Crusade. This was, of course, Peter the Hermit. Up until the late 1800s, the accepted version of events was that Peter started preaching the crusade before Pope Urban formally launched the endeavor at the Council of Clermont. The story I told in the introduction was widely believed to be the historical truth. And as such, Peter the Hermit had a reputation for being the true initiator of the crusade. This was until 1879, when the great German historian Heinrich Hagenmeier published his hugely influential book on the life of Peter the Hermit. Hagenmeier was one of the first historians to thoroughly evaluate the primary sources on Peter. After doing so, he came to the conclusion that the evidence simply did not suggest that Peter had launched the crusade. He pointed out that many of our key sources on Peter's life don't mention his early trip to Jerusalem, and they're contradicted by other sources that suggest that he tried to go but didn't make it. It was Hagenmeier's opinion that Peter may have been inspired by a vision of God, or that Peter thought he was inspired by a vision of God, but it was highly unlikely that this vision happened in Jerusalem. It was even more unlikely that he met the patriarch, and it was almost certain that he had not met with the Pope and convinced him to launch the crusade. The story of the vision in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was, according to Hagenmeier, most likely little more than a legend promoted by later and potentially unreliable chroniclers. In other words, he believed that it was some fake history. But here's the thing about history. It's not a static thing. And it was only a matter of time before other historians started reading the sources for themselves and drawing their own conclusions. Now, to Hagenmeier's credit, his thesis on Peter basically stood unchallenged for about 100 years. It wasn't until 1985 that a proper challenge to Hagenmeier's view appeared in academia. Historians like Colin Morris and E.O. Blake would propose that some of the sources that Hagenmeier had thrown on the junk heap might actually have more to them than he had supposed. Blake and Morris's investigation of Peter the Hermit didn't so much disprove Hagenmeier's assessment as it complicated it. Their point was that the things that Hagenmeier dismissed as legends perhaps should not be so quickly dismissed. After all, if Peter hadn't been to the Holy Land before the Crusade, then his fanatical devotion to the cause becomes far more difficult to understand. The story simply makes more sense if the First Crusade was personal for Peter the Hermit. But of course, just because one story seems to make better narrative sense does not necessarily mean that it's true. So today, let's take a closer look at Peter the Hermit and the so-called popular crusade that he whipped up and see if we can draw some conclusions about this deeply controversial figure. The tricky thing about Peter the Hermit is that for one of the most significant people in medieval Europe, we can barely say anything about him for certain. There is considerable disagreement in the sources over even the most basic facts. When he was born, where he was from, and even his real name are the subjects of controversy. So let me start by saying that before the year 1095, there is no real reliable information about this guy. So everything I'm about to tell you may very well be completely wrong. Nonetheless, the best guess that we have is that Peter was born in 1053, or thereabouts. He was most likely the son of a minor noble from the French region of Auvergne named Reynold l'Hermite. That means that if some sources are correct, Peter the Hermit wasn't just a nickname. It was literally his name. Pierre l'Hermite is just French for Peter the Hermit. So this has led some to suggest that he wasn't actually a hermit at all. It may have just been his last name. Now, this theory is usually supported by the fact that Peter's activities during the Crusades are not very hermit-like. Religious hermits hide away from the world in a type of pious solitude. Peter was out there whipping up crowds into frenzies and convincing them to wage holy war. So, Peter the Hermit may not have even been a hermit. In fact, if this one particular thread is to be believed, he may not have always been a cleric either. Peter may have started his life as a knight. There is some evidence to suggest that he fought in Flanders, was captured, and then ransomed due to his high status. This Peter the Knight backstory would help explain why he felt so confident leading an armed band of holy warriors to the east. He may have had some military training. After being ransomed back, one tradition has it that he was married, fathered two children, and was then completely devastated after his wife suddenly died. It was after this personal tragedy that he apparently renounced all of his worldly possessions and devoted his life to God. It was also during this time that he may have actually spent some time living as a hermit in a forest in France. So, I don't know, guys. Either Peter the Hermit got his name because of this stint spent in the wilderness, or he got his name because his dad was named Hermit. Or maybe it was both. But that seems crazy, right? I mean, the guy was born with the last name Hermit, and then he actually became a hermit? I mean, this has led some to argue that no, his name couldn't have been L'Ermite, because maybe last names didn't even properly exist in France during this period. So clearly he got his name because he lived in solitude for a spell. And then, of course, there's the possibility that both are true. His last name was L'Ermite, and then poetically, he lived up to his last name by becoming a hermit. I suppose stranger things have happened. So, right off the bat, you get a sense of how slippery this figure is. The man who for centuries was given credit for starting the First Crusade is basically a ghost before the year 1095. I mean, when you can't even say for certain if a guy named Peter the Hermit was actually a hermit, that should tell you a lot about who you're dealing with. Nevertheless, after 1095, Peter explodes onto the scene in a very dramatic way. In the months following Urban II's call for a crusade at Clermont, a grassroots movement started to take place in the villages of Western and Central Europe. Low-level monks and wandering holy men started to preach the crusade to the peasants. Now, most historians believe that Urban had always wanted this mission to the east to defend the Byzantines to be a knights-only affair. As we discussed last week, it had been Urban's hope that it would be Western Europe's military caste who would take up the cross. This would serve the double function of hopefully repairing relations with the Eastern Christians while giving the Western peasantry a break from torment at the hands of the knights. But these preachers on the ground thought that those very peasants who the Pope was hoping to protect should be the ones liberating the Holy Land. For them, this was a mission for all Christians. By far the most charismatic of all of these grassroots preachers was Peter the Hermit. Starting in the French countryside, Peter began to cobble together his own peasant army that he himself was going to lead. He looked the part of the perfect wandering holy man. He wore a simple homespun cloak, he went barefoot everywhere, and of course, he rode a donkey, because you can't be a humble servant of God unless you're on a donkey. But all the sources agree that he was an absolutely magnetic speaker who had this nearly magical ability to captivate a crowd. He would go into town squares or to the tops of local hills or any other popular public meeting place and start sermonizing. Crowds would gather, and by the end of his speech, there were always a few dozen people who were ready to completely drop everything and join this guy on his campaign. He was just that good. We're even told that he was so charismatic that he was able to move crowds even when he was preaching to them in a language they didn't understand. Peter's quest to rouse the peasantry of Europe eventually took him out of France and into Germany, where apparently he was just as successful inspiring crowds, despite the fact that he didn't speak German. Over the course of a few months, Peter was able to convince tens of thousands of regular Europeans to drop everything and follow him to the Holy Land. In April of 1096, Peter gathered an army of 40,000 people in Cologne that he would personally lead east. On top of that, there were two other huge bodies of peasant crusaders, one from France and another from Germany, that were also heading east with a plan to rendezvous in Constantinople with Peter. This massive exodus of European peasantry and minor nobles has been called the People's Crusade, the Popular Crusade, the Peasants' Crusade, and the Paupers' Crusade. Some historians estimate that as many as 100,000 people, whipped up by Peter the Hermit and other preachers like him, left their homes to invade the Holy Land in 1096. So, let's just take a moment here to reflect on what just happened. At the end of November in 1095, Urban II puts out the call for a crusade. By April, barely 6 months later, he has completely lost control of this thing. There are now 100,000 peasants and minor knights marching east, and some obscure holy man named Peter the Hermit is now calling the shots. As the great Ron Burgundy once said,
"Boy, that escalated quickly. I mean, that really got out of hand fast."
I couldn't agree more, Ron. And so, we have to ask, what happened here? How do you explain this? Why were so many poor Europeans so ready to drop everything and follow an obscure monk into the Holy Land? Well, let's take a closer look. When you read some chronicles of the First Crusade, it can seem like Peter the Hermit created this movement by force of personality alone. Now, there's no doubt that the man was remarkable, but it's important to remember that he was not acting alone. Most historians believe that Peter was one of dozens and potentially hundreds of preachers who were actively out there preaching the crusade. They were also armed with some very persuasive arguments. You see, historian Philip Dilatter, who I've been referencing a lot in this series, has put it out there that it was these low-level preachers who really gave the First Crusade its mission. It was these men who made Jerusalem the goal. They most likely were not preaching about helping the Byzantines. Most Western Europeans were either completely ignorant of the Byzantine Empire or harbored a vaguely negative prejudice against a group that they just called, quote, the Greeks. In other words, you weren't going to get many recruits trying to drum up sympathy for the Byzantines. Jerusalem, on the other hand, held an extremely important place in the mind of an average European. For instance, medieval world maps always placed Jerusalem in the center. For these peasants, Jerusalem was not just the center of their spiritual world, it was also the center of their understanding of geography. As such, liberating Jerusalem was a much more enticing goal. As we explored in the last episode, it also played into expectations about the apocalypse. People were ready to drop everything and liberate Jerusalem because it could potentially start a chain reaction of events culminating in the Second Coming. Then, there was the whole remission of sins thing. As we heard last episode, the chronicler Fulcher of Chartres reported that Urban II promised a complete remission of sins to anyone who embarked on the crusade. Any crimes on your record would be wiped clean. However, many historians believe that the Pope did not initially promise this complete remission. That was something that Fulcher added to the record after the fact. Instead, some have proposed that the Pope actually only promised a remission of penance. So, what's a remission of penance? Well, it means that to get right with the church, you don't need to do any more earthly works, like fasting or making pilgrimage or serving the poor. More importantly, though, a remission of penance doesn't necessarily mean that all of your sins are forgiven. God might decide that your soul might still need to spend a little time in purgatory before you get to go to the big show. Well, that nuance also didn't make for good recruiting. So these guys on the ground once again sweetened things up. That remission of penance was purposefully misheard or just straight up changed to a complete remission of sins and a direct ticket to paradise. Some historians have proposed that it was only after this idea caught on at the grassroots level that the Pope essentially rubber stamped it. These preachers also motivated people by telling them tales of Turkish atrocities in the Holy Land. Now, we don't have precise records of the exact things said by Peter the Hermit or any other leader. However, there is evidence of one particularly nasty rumor that was circulated in the lead-up to the crusade. This was the so-called Massacre of the Great German Pilgrimage. You see, in the year 1065, there actually had been a huge group of 12,000 Germans that set out on a pilgrimage for Jerusalem. Now, the myth was that on Good Friday, only a 2 days' journey from the Holy City, the entire group was captured by Muslims and led to a nearby hill. There, every last one of them, including the women and children, were slaughtered. Their only crime was being Christian in Muslim territory. This story proved to be such a potent piece of propaganda that it has lived on well beyond the 11th century. To this day, you can still find this particular tale on many historically dubious websites trying to justify the crusade. But this story is without a doubt a historical myth. It's a complete distortion of the actual historical record to fit a narrative about Muslim cruelty. What the sources actually tell us is that the German pilgrimage was harassed by bandits throughout its entire trip, and that included in Christian Europe. These pilgrims were wealthy, and as a result, they attracted the attention of thieves. Now, it is true that the pilgrims were the victims of a particularly vicious robbery not far outside of Jerusalem. The assailants were a band of Bedouins, one of the many nomadic Arabic peoples roaming the Middle East at the time. To be fair, this robbery was violent and many of the pilgrims were killed. The exact number is hard to say, but it was only a fraction of the overall party. And it most certainly was not all 12,000. But perhaps the most important part of the story that gets omitted by those trying to drum up hate against Muslims is that the German pilgrimage was actually saved by the forces commanded by the Fatimid governor of Ramallah. So, yeah, the German pilgrimage was rescued by Muslims. Now, why were they saved? Because Christian pilgrimages to Jerusalem were an important source of revenue for the local economy. It was in the Fatimids' interest to keep the pilgrimage routes safe and free from bandits. They wanted Christians visiting Jerusalem and were no way pleased by the bad PR that would come as the result of this Bedouin attack. The myth of the event would have us believe that every last pilgrim was slaughtered by people who had been officially sanctioned to destroy them, precisely because they were Christian. But the truth was actually the exact opposite. The pilgrims were attacked by bandits who were motivated by greed and a desire for treasure. These pilgrims were not killed because they were Christian. In fact, they were rescued by Muslims because they were Christians. But of course, the complicated truth of this event did not make for good crusading propaganda. Instead, it was stories like the slaughter of the 12,000 on Easter that got peppered into the fiery sermons of those preaching the First Crusade. So, altogether, Peter the Hermit and the other low-level preachers promised the people a remission of sins that the Pope had probably not intended. They focused the mission on Jerusalem, which played to their audience's apocalyptic expectations. And they whipped up their hatred with trumped-up tales of atrocities. This meant that by April of 1096, you had tens of thousands of common people ready to converge en masse on the Holy Land. But, as you might imagine, a mob of thousands fueled by a dangerous tonic of religious hatred, apocalyptic expectation, and a belief that all of their actions were completely sin-free made for a pretty volatile situation. In a bitter twist, the first people to feel the wrath of the so-called popular crusade were not Turks, Arabs, or any other Muslim people. It was European Jews. Once these bands of crusaders mustered in France and Germany in 1096, the first people they went after were the local Jewish populations. This was especially true in Germany. The body of German crusaders, who notably were not being led by Peter the Hermit, began their holy mission by looting Jewish neighborhoods, forcing Jews to convert on pain of death, and straight up murdering Jews who got in their way. On their trek to the Holy Land, this group of German crusaders actually made long detours just so they could raid towns and cities that were known to have large Jewish populations. Now, I'm sure you're wondering, why go after the Jews? Well, part of it had to do with the belief that this crusade was going to bring about the Second Coming. Remember, legend had it that the Emperor of the Last Days was going to convert all of the last non-believers. So this led to the belief that if the Jews did not convert, this would somehow stall the Second Coming. However, I don't think we should also rule out the basic motive of racial hatred and ingrained anti-Semitism. A mob that has been motivated to violence against a racial and religious other is a terrifying thing and will often lash out at anyone perceived as an outsider. The Jews were just sadly nearby. And if I can editorialize for a second, something that I've noticed in our own times is that Islamophobia and anti-Semitism tend to be close cousins. This is darkly ironic given the ongoing tensions between Jews and Muslims in the Middle East. But in Europe and North America, those who tend to be the most strident in their anti-Islam views also tend to harbor some rather nasty opinions about Jews. But that's just my own personal observation. In 1096, at least, this seemed to be the case. Now, it should be noted that many local Christian church officials did their best to protect the local Jewish communities from the wrath of the crusaders. There are many examples of local bishops turning their cathedrals and homes into sanctuaries for Jews. This sometimes even led to these holy places being destroyed by crusaders eager to murder Jewish people. One of the most dramatic moments of violence came at Worms, where some 800 Jews were killed when they refused to be baptized. During the battle at the city of Mainz, another 1,100 were massacred. On top of that, mass suicides also became common. Many Jews chose to take their own lives rather than give up their faith or face the wrath of the crusaders. In the end, it's estimated that well over 2,000 Jews were killed or committed suicide before the popular crusade moved east. Historians often cite this outburst of anti-Jewish violence as a turning point in the history of anti-Semitism in Europe. In the view of some historians, this was just the first of many violent pogroms that would eventually culminate in the Holocaust. It is a dark chapter in the history of Europe and an important moment to consider when evaluating the merits of the First Crusade. The People's Crusade began with this vicious outburst of anti-Semitic violence. But how would it end? Well, let's take a look at what became of Peter the Hermit's peasant army as they made their way to the east. The Popular Crusade may have been one of the greatest fizzle-outs in human history. It's hard to think of another mass movement that so quickly imploded. But perhaps the entire initiative was doomed from the outset. You see, when Urban II called for the crusade, he had set August 1096 as the departure date. This would give the nobility time to muster their knights, and it would notably put them on the road to Constantinople during the fall harvest season. This would mean that the crusading armies would be more easily fed when they rolled into friendly towns, and if they needed to live off the land, there would simply be more food around. The Popular Crusade, on the other hand, was so eager to set off that they left in decidedly less abundant times. They left in the spring, the hungry times. Now, as much as we've been saying that the Popular Crusade was led by Peter the Hermit, he was really only in control of one group who had gathered in Cologne. There were two other main bodies of peasant crusaders also on the move in early 1096. One was led by a French knight named Walter Sans Avoir, and another was led by a German noble named Count Emico. It was Emico's contingent who were mostly responsible for the atrocities against the Jews that we just discussed. But the first of these groups to make it to Byzantine territory was the French contingent led by Sans Avoir. When this massive group of peasants and minor knights turned up in Belgrade, several months before any crusaders were expected, they completely took the local governor by surprise. The Byzantines were not about to let a rowdy group of peasants enter their city, so they barred the gates. Now, the peasants were basically starving, so they started to raid and pillage the countryside. To stop the violence, the Byzantines had to dispatch their garrisons and then had to violently bring the pillagers to heel. To avoid the Byzantine forces, the crusaders then doubled back into Hungary, a country that they had just passed through without incident. There, they raided local markets and clashed with the thoroughly shocked Hungarians. So, right off the hop here, we have our crusaders actively killing and raiding other Christians and being fought by the Byzantines, the very group they had been summoned to help. The violence and starving greatly diminished the numbers of this group, and mass desertions also started to become common. Nevertheless, the Byzantines were eventually able to violently quell the raiding crusaders and then escorted them under arms to Constantinople. The next group of crusaders to make their way east were the 40,000 led by Peter the Hermit himself. When they got to the borders of Hungary, the Hungarian king was now somewhat suspicious of the popular crusade and at first denied them entry. But after meeting with Peter the Hermit, he said he would allow them to pass through so long as Peter swore a solemn oath that no Hungarians would be robbed or killed. Peter swore the oath, but very quickly lost control of the situation. While passing through the very town that earlier bands of crusaders had raided, someone from his contingent got into a dumb argument over the price of a pair of shoes in the marketplace. This argument turned into a riot, which in turn turned into a pitched battle. This culminated in the crusaders burning and sacking the local citadel. To escape reprisals from the Hungarians, they then fled across the border into Byzantine territory, and things went about as well when they got there. In a desperate attempt to organize and control Peter's massive group of peasant warriors, the Byzantines paid some mercenaries to oversee their crossing of a bridge at the River Sava. This would also give the Byzantines an opportunity to count and take stock of this somewhat ramshackle force. Well, this would prove to be yet another brutal disaster. The crusaders got impatient and started to kill the Byzantine forces, who they blamed for slowing their passage. Once they'd killed the Byzantines at the River Sava, the crusaders proceeded to pillage the countryside and eventually stormed the city of Belgrade itself. There, they looted the city, burned it, and then carried on towards the provincial capital of Nice. The Byzantine governor did his best to work out a deal with Peter the Hermit that would get the crusaders out of his territory and onto Constantinople as soon as possible. But at this point, the crusader force had a mind of its own. Despite Peter's orders that they stop raiding the countryside and attacking the people they were supposed to be protecting, bands of crusaders continued doing exactly that. Tensions escalated to the point where the Byzantine governor mustered his troops and mounted a full-on attack on the people of the popular crusade. The army of peasants was no match, and they were soundly defeated. It's estimated that roughly a quarter of them were killed by the Byzantines. In the lead up to the battle, Peter the Hermit would, for the first time, pull a move that would become one of his trademarks, and that was run away. Basically, anytime this guy loses control of the situation, which, if you haven't noticed, happens early and often in this story, he ditches his people and runs away. So if you wanted to make the case that Peter the Hermit was a bit of a charlatan, well, here's Exhibit A. Losing a quarter of your fighting force is no small thing, but the crusaders were still determined to make it to the Holy Land. They went out and tracked down their runaway leader hiding in the nearby hills. And then, despite their brutal defeat, at the hands of their allies no less, the group decided to push on to Constantinople, and they eventually dragged themselves to the city. Finally, Count Emicho and his German crusade turned up on the borders of Hungary. Now, why did it take them so long? Well, as we said, they were busy raiding the Jewish communities of Germany. Now, by the time they turn up in Hungary, the king had pretty much had his fill of crusading Westerners, and he flat out refused to let Emicho and his army through his country. Emicho responded by putting the Christian Hungarian city of Moson under siege. But the Hungarians were simply better equipped and better trained than Emicho's patchwork force of minor knights and commoners. The Hungarians scored a devastating victory over Emicho. Most of his forces were killed, others were scattered, and for his part, Emicho turned around and went home to Germany. His crusade was over. So, Let's take stock here. By the time the popular crusade rendezvoused at the walls of Constantinople in the summer of 1096, they were a pale shadow of what they were just a few months before. They had been successful only in massacring thousands of Jews, devastating German cities in the process, pillaging and terrorizing their fellow Christians, and making war both on the Hungarians and the Byzantines, people who were essentially their allies. What had once been a force of potentially 100,000 was now not even half that size, and was looking considerably worse for wear. Nevertheless, the Crusaders were now on Emperor Alexius's doorstep. This ragtag group of zealous peasants certainly had not been the army he ordered, and he was no doubt more than a little upset that they had pillaged his country, razed one of his cities, and engaged in a pitched battle with one of his provincial garrisons. This was not at all going the way he had hoped. However, a better organized group of crusaders, made up of real knights and led by European nobility, were still on their way. So in the meantime, the emperor had a decision to make. Either he could keep the people's crusade around in hopes that they might one day eventually prove useful, or he could get some bloody revenge. Okay, that's all for this week. Thanks again for listening to the show. Join us in 2 weeks' time when we will find out what the fate of the popular crusade will be. And we will wrap up our entire series on the First Crusade. Before we go this week, I want to give a big shout out to Heather Ling, to Kevin Chismar, to Molly Desjardins, to Nathan Ills, and to Deborah White. All of you lovely people have decided to pledge $5 or more on Patreon every month. So obviously that makes you beautiful human beings. Thank you so much for your support. I cannot tell you how much it means to me. If you would like to support the show, and yes, I'm talking to you, that person who's been listening for a while and really likes it and has always kind of thought about supporting, but it's like, I didn't get around to it. And this is for you. If you want to do it, go to patreon.com/ourfakehistory. Take a look at what you get at the $1, $3, and $5 levels of support. There's all sorts of fun extras. I'll often surprise patrons with little extras. And once we hit the next Patreon goal, all the patrons get to vote on what the next extra episode will be. It's a lot of fun, and honestly, it's the best way to keep this podcast going. If you are not down with the every month contribution, then go to the website, go to ourfakehistory.com, and you can do a one-time donation, or you can buy one-off extra episodes. All of that helps too. If you don't have the extra money to support the show, I get it. Come on. It's hard times all over. So one nice way you can support the show is just go and write a nice review on iTunes or on any other podcast app that lets you review the shows. It helps. Or just drop me a line. Say hello. Write me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. Send me a message on Facebook or hit me up on Twitter at at Our Fake History. And the Facebook group is facebook.com/ourfakehistory. I've been getting more messages than ever, so I'm sorry if I'm a little tardy on the responses these days, but I'll do my very best to get back to each and every one of you. I really do like hearing from you. I read absolutely everything that comes through, and I really do my best to respond to everything too. So if you haven't got a message back, don't worry, just wait. I will get around to you. Finally, before we go this week, I want to give another shout out to a great podcaster out there who I know I've shouted out before on this podcast, but you know, he deserves another one. He is the wonderful Daniele Bolelli. If you are not listening to History on Fire, you are denying yourself an important History Podcast. All right. We all know in the world of history podcasts, the big boys are your Dan Carlins, your Mike Duncans, right? Danielli has burst on the scene in the last few years as one of their equals in the world of history podcasting. And on top of that, he's a great guy. He's been a really wonderful supporter of this show as well, and I'm honored that he's out there listening. I am an avid listener to his show. He just did an amazing series on the boxer Jack Johnson, who is the first black heavyweight champion of the world. That series is a must listen. I absolutely adored it. Right now, he's talking about gladiators in ancient Rome. You gotta love it. So History on Fire, if you're not listening to that. If you're more interested in discussions about spirituality or mixed martial arts, all of those things are talked about on The Drunken Taoist, his other podcast that he puts out. So if you're not checking out what Daniele Bolelli's doing out there, I think you should. I think you should. Go do it. And thanks, Daniele, for all the really nice things you've been saying about this show. I'm glad you listened to it with your daughter. Give my love to your little girl. That's really cool. I think that's awesome. All right. The theme music for the show comes to us, as always, from Dirty Church. You can check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. And all the other music that you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.